Okay, well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for spending a little bit of time with us this afternoon. There are lots of things that compete for our time, and we really appreciate you making the decision to be here. I hope we will make it informative and interesting. Just a little bit of housekeeping up front. We have the lines muted. If anyone has any questions along the way, please feel free to email them to us at theshantmantionegroup.com, and we'll pick those up and pass those on to John. I've already collected several questions, and we're pretty excited. So anyone who doesn't know me or recognize my voice, I'm Andrew Shantz, one of the partners at the Shantz Mantione Group. We are joined today. This is a reprisal of a call we did, I think, back in May, John, by John Savercools, Managing Director and Head of the UBS Office of Public Policy. We like to think of John as our person in Washington who's there, so we don't have to be. He has all the connections and knows just about everybody, so we're fortunate that we get to have some conversations with him from time to time. Originally, John, I thought we would be focused pretty much on the nomination of Amy Barrett for Supreme Court Justice to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But you know what? So much has happened since then. I feel like we may have a few more things to talk about. So what I'd like to do is start by giving you a few minutes to give us an overview, maybe start presidential election focused, an overview there, and then we'll drill down, and then we've got some fairly specific questions after that. Does that sound like it makes sense?
Sure. And hello, everyone. I hope everyone's doing well. It's nice to visit with you again. I hope everyone is healthy. Andrew, I think just the right overview might be just a little bit about the election, a little bit about Washington in general. In Washington, the House and Senate are out of session, but the two issues kind of looming over Washington right now are, one, the status of the next stimulus bill. People have probably observed that Republicans want a more targeted bill. Democrats want a bigger bill, more comprehensive bill. The two versions now are roughly about $500 billion apart. So that's the negotiating ground they have to make up if they're going to get a package. The markets seem to have been expecting a package, so they've reacted up and down to this. There's a chance that there may be a side deal on some individual provisions, or maybe on an individual provision of just granting more cash to airlines workers to avert layoffs in that sector. The money that they had gotten through previous bills expired at the end of September. So there's some urgency there. So we might see something on that, but that's probably about it until the election. The other is the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to serve as a Supreme Court Justice. The Senate Judiciary Committee will hold hearings next week. So the big day that most people will watch will be Tuesday. Tuesday is the day that senators will ask questions and the nominee will answer. And if there are any fireworks or volatility or hostile questioning or tension or anything like that, it's likely to occur on that day. Monday will be just time reserved for opening remarks by members of the committee. They'll be tense too, and they'll be very opinionated, both for and against her and the process and the timing and all those things. But Tuesday will probably be the more interesting days. Then Wednesday, Thursday will be reserved for outside witnesses who can comment on the nominee. Everything should go. Republicans have the votes to confirm her if Republicans still support her after the hearings. She's been before the Judiciary Committee before, and she's done well, and she's articulate. So things should go well for her in the hearing, and I expect a confirmation the following week. It could get held up if more senators on the committee, more Republican senators specifically, get COVID. Three Republican senators on the committee have COVID. And this is important because while senators can participate in the hearings next week virtually, they cannot vote virtually. They have to vote in person. So they have to be well enough to actually come back to Washington and cast their vote in the committee. The three with COVID are expected to be cleared to be able to come back, and they're supposed to be well enough by then that they'll be safe and they can come back and vote. But if another member is infected, if is diagnosed from now until the vote, that could complicate matters, and it may prevent Republicans from having enough votes. So that possibility looms out there. It's not really talked about, but it looms out there. And if you don't like her nomination or don't want a new Supreme Court justice, that's the kind of path you would hope for. Otherwise, her confirmation seems pretty secure if all goes well on the health front for Republicans. On the campaign trail, it's really hard for me to look at how things are going and look at the polls and look at the sentiment in the different states and to make any other conclusion than Joe Biden is winning and is winning pretty comfortably. That's not only reflected in the national polls, but it's reflected in the state polls in the key swing states. And I think this is, it's hard to refute the polling if you have any faith in the polling. And I know that some people don't. I'm often asked by people, how can I rely on the polls? And I remind them that in 2016, the polls, the national polls, showed Hillary Clinton as a winner in the national vote count by 3 percentage points. She actually won by 2.1 percentage points. So the national polls in 2016 were accurate as they related to the national polls. The problem was in the state polling, where there was just a dearth of polling. So no one really knew what was happening in some states, including those states of Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, normally blue states, but voted for Trump that year. So not a lot of people knew that other than Trump himself and his campaign, and credit to them for having a good ear to the ground. But there wasn't a lot of polling, so people were surprised, and they just figured that Clinton was going to win the national vote, and that would allow her to win the electoral vote. But the polling wasn't bad nationally. It was just either non-existent or inconclusive in the key swing states. So the polling this year has been pretty consistent. The polling that I've checked over the last week have all been polling people based on the representation around the country in terms of their party affiliation. Our country has roughly 38% of our people are registered as Democrats, 31 or 32% are registered as Republican. The remaining 30 or 31% are registered with neither party, or they're registered as independents. So the polling is actually geared toward a group of people who make up that composition. I do think that they're probably more right than wrong, although they're certainly going to be inaccuracies. Polling has always confounded me because it requires someone on the phone to call someone at their house and to ask them if they'll participate in a poll. And most people I know don't answer their home phone, or maybe they don't have a home phone number. If you're like me, when the home phone rings, you look at it like someone's committing a capital crime, and you have no faith in who's calling you because you just assume it's some spammer or someone trying to get your business. So the polling we think is accurate, even if it's not, even if there is a silent Trump vote out there, which there probably is, it's probably worth a couple percentage points. And when you're down between 5 and 10 points, that's going to help you, but it's not going to reverse the result. So we see a Biden win, and that'll probably carry over to the Senate, and Democrats will have a good day, I think, and will probably control Washington for at least the next couple of years. Between 4 to 5 million people have already voted, so voting is already ongoing. Trump could still come back and win, but he's got limited days to do it, and he's running out of opportunities. The first debate didn't help. Last night probably helped a little bit, but not enough to be a significant game changer. And if they're going to call off the next debate, then Trump really can't benefit from there. So he's running out of opportunities. And we'll see what happens. I'll just make one other note, Andrew, about Election Day watching. So when we're all watching Election Day returns after dinner, keep in mind the early states that will be reporting. Florida will report early. Some of the other East Coast states, North Carolina, Pennsylvania. Florida is probably the most important. It's the biggest of those states. And Florida begins counting their mail-in ballots the day they get them. So they don't have a restriction that prevents them from counting only on Election Day and beyond, such as states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan. They can only begin to count their mail-in ballots on the day of the election. So they're certainly going to be late in their count. But Florida should have a result for us by the time the polls close or shortly thereafter, which I think will either be 7 or 8 p.m. So we'll know about Florida's result early, and that'll be a big result. If Republicans have won Florida the last few years, Trump really has to win it. It's a big state. He can't afford to lose that state. If Biden wins Florida, then I think it's an indication that the evening's going to be a good night for Biden and Democrats. If Trump wins Florida, then it tells you that Trump is still in it, and we got to go on to the next states to determine who's going to win. Pennsylvania will probably be inconclusive because their mail-in ballots won't be counted in a final way. North Carolina is another key eastern state, but they get to accept mail-in ballots up to a week after the election, as long as the ballots are postmarked by election day. So we may not know their full count either. The whole thing with mail-in ballots, it just depends how close the race is. If a candidate is winning by more than the number, if he or she's winning by more votes than there are outstanding mail-in ballots, then the mail-in ballot late counting doesn't really matter. But if it's closer than that, then it will matter. And we'll just have to see on election night. So why don't I end there, and we'll move on and talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Thank you. That really kind of sets the stage. Of course, it generated more questions in my head as opposed to answering them. So let's talk about the polling a little bit, because obviously that seems to be a bit of a lightning rod. You mentioned the 2016 election. Is it your impression, you're saying there's a pretty good handle on the national polling numbers and better handling on the state numbers, given the friction between winning the national election and then winning the Electoral College? Do you think that the polling numbers accurately represent what will happen with those electoral votes?
I think so, unless I'm given evidence to the contrary, and my contacts in those states believe that the polls are largely accurate as well. Some have some skepticism, but it's not a wholesale rejection of them. It's a questioning of who they're polling. Even people who are skeptical about the polls, I think, suggest that they may be off by a couple of points. But if Trump is losing by 10, and if you give him a couple points because of bad polling, then, he's down by 7. He's still losing. So the overwhelming sentiment is that the polls are right in the sense that Biden is winning. The margin of winning can be contested. Sometimes polls only poll people who are registered voters versus those who are not only registered but likely to vote. And the polls that reflect those who are most likely to vote are deemed to be the most accurate. So those are the polls to watch and pay most attention to. And they show, by and large, a Biden lead of 7 to 8 points. Among registered voters, the margin is a little wider. Of course, we don't know who's going to vote. 40 to 45% of our people who are registered don't vote anyway, so we don't know who's going to decide not to vote. But however you look at the polling number, it's hard to find a lot of good things for Trump unless you just reject the polling, as many people do who I talk to. And in fact, many people who I have a lot of respect for and who are very smart, they just believe that there's a movement out there that wasn't accounted for in 16, isn't being accounted for now, and that they think will result in a Trump win. So, that may happen. Trump may win, but I don't see any evidence of that. I see more evidence to the contrary, at least today.
Okay. We have a question submitted, and actually this is more of a general question. In terms of the debates, and first, we'll stick to the presidential election and the original debates. And now I guess they were going to go try a virtual debate. And in President Trump, as at least the last time I saw, because things change so quickly these days, he would not participate in a virtual debate. Do you have a sense if that may change, or is that just posturing, or, as you said before, is it really going to help him either way?
Well, I think that the debates, if you look at the remaining calendar between now and election day, of course, some things will happen that we can't predict. I mean, none of us predicted that Trump would get COVID or that Ruth Bader Ginsburg would pass away and that a Supreme Court vacancy would all of a sudden be an issue. maybe we'll still have some October surprises left in this campaign. Certainly both campaigns will try to plant October surprises, like the New York Times piece on Trump's tax payments, or a couple of weeks ago, Trump had a peace signing agreement with some Middle Eastern countries. I mean, those are all events designed to kind of serve campaign purposes. So the debate, you know, there's only two left. And if you remove one, if you eliminate one, then that takes away a big opportunity for Trump. So I don't really understand his thinking that this could benefit him. I understand that I think he's trying to put pressure on the debate committee to reverse their decision and have a live event rather than a virtual event. But I don't know what the committee will decide. It is a bipartisan committee that was set up to deal with these kind of disagreements. So Biden has indicated that he will participate in a town hall meeting that will be set up like the debate was supposed to be set up. I think that Trump really wants to be in the debate, but he wants it to be live rather than virtual. So I don't think he'll give up. I don't think we've heard the last word on this. Trump really thinks he has an opportunity in a live debate to make up ground. And I think he'll push for a live debate. So I don't think we've heard the last of this. And the truth is, Trump needs as many opportunities as he can to kind of shake up the dynamics of this race. And this debate is one of them. So I think he needs it more than Biden needs it.
Okay. So I certainly tuned into the vice presidential debate last night, as did a lot of people that I know. Were there any surprises in there for you other than the fly? Were there any other surprises? And do you think that, or to what extent do you feel that the vice presidential debates have an impact on the presidential election?
Well, they usually don't. I don't know of anyone who votes for a candidate based on who his vice president is. Usually people don't pay much attention to the vice president's or the candidates for vice president, unless they make a big mistake. And that was what last night was all about. I guess more people watched it because they thought that both Kamala Harris and Mike Pence might be replacements to the two presidential nominees at some point. So maybe there was a little more viewership last night. Maybe there's some curiosity about Harris just to see what she was like for those people who didn't know or who were less familiar with her. I thought the debate was pretty good. I thought both were actually pretty good. Pence was his usual disciplined, articulate self. Harris, in my view, was not a great debater in the Democratic debate. Wasn't particularly great last night, but she didn't make any mistakes, and that was the key. And I think both kind of did what they had to do. Both did as well as they could do. I don't think it's a big deal for the campaign. Would have been if Harris or Pence had made a big mistake or had said something really stupid. But I think both kind of got out of it what they needed, and we now move on. And I don't think it really affected the race very much in any significant way.
Okay. I think I was going to ask you a little bit about the sort of contentious state Senate races, but it seems like from your early conversations on the polling data that you feel like those are leaning towards favoring the Democrats. Would you say that was accurate?
Yeah, I think whoever wins the presidency is likely to help the nominees from their party in the Senate races. And to that end, if you look at the makeup right now, it's 53 Republican, 47 Democrat. There is one seat in Alabama held by a Democrat that will flip. Very, very good chance that that'll flip and Republican will win that seat. So let's assume that Republicans have 54, Democrats have 46. Democrats would have to gain four seats, and assuming Biden wins, they would have the majority with 50 votes, since the majority tiebreaker goes to the party in power in the White House. So they have to win four seats. I think they've probably already won seats held by Republicans in Democratic states like Maine and Colorado. Those states look really difficult for Republicans to hold on to. So that cuts it to two. And then you have probably six or eight seats that are razor thin or the Democrat is winning, like in the states of Arizona, North Carolina, Montana, Iowa, Georgia, even in Texas. a longtime red state, Senator John Cornyn is projected to be up by 2 points. In South Carolina, Lindsey Graham is losing now to his Democratic challenger. So, and these are in Republican states. One of the other states I mentioned, maybe I didn't mention, was Montana, where the Democratic governor is challenging the Republican incumbent. So the fact that we're talking about Democrats being competitive in reliably Republican states suggests that there's something going on that is really favoring Democrats in this election. So I do believe that there are enough seats of those six that I just mentioned to give Democrats the other 2 seats they need to have a majority. In a Biden win, I think it's very, very likely that Democrats would win enough seats to produce a Democratic majority.
Okay, well, we're definitely leaning a particular way here. That's, if we have time, I do want to go back and talk about stimulus a little bit. But another conversation that I had just this morning with a client was asking about, in a Biden win, in a generally Democratic win in the Senate, what do you think, and we've had a number of conversations about what some of the changes will be, what do you think the magnitude of change will be under a President Biden, assuming that he wins? Is this going to be a measured marginal change, or is this going to be more radical change in terms of taxes and regulations and healthcare and all of the other things that are on the table?
Well, you know, I personally believe that it will be more significant than just kind of a reshuffling of the deck. I mean, I think it'll be significant. I think you'll see a completely different in substance behind the policy agenda for 2021 and 2022. Democrats have been out of power for 4 years. They've got a big laundry list of items that they'd like to do. They've opposed just about everything Trump has done for the last 4 years. So they want to try to reverse all that, and they want to enact a bunch of new stuff. So yeah, I suspect it'll be a dramatically different agenda, and it will tilt toward, it'll go back and forth between the middle and the far left of Democratic Party politics. I mean, anytime a party has the presidency, the one thing they want to do before they go into the next election is to be unified as a party. And if they're going to be unified, then Biden's going to have to give some things to the more moderate factions and give some things to the more progressive factions. So, you know, I think we'll see him going back and forth in an effort to keep unity in the party. I still think the first issue will be any kind of response to COVID that Democrats still feel a need. So if there's not a bipartisan stimulus bill done this year, they will try to enact one next year. And it will be closer to Nancy Pelosi's bill than maybe a more moderate bill that would come out of the Senate. That would be the first order of business, and that would be done relatively quickly. Biden would be inaugurated in late January. He'd have to pick a cabinet, and you know, they all need approval. So it'd take a little while to kind of get the team together and to get the team working at their agencies. But I still think the first order of business after COVID would be a tax increase bill. And I say that because Democrats are a little split on some issues like healthcare, energy issues. They're not entirely unified. Biden would want a unifying issue, and tax increases fit the bill because Democrats largely believe they're needed to address income inequality. So a rise in the corporate tax rate, reinstating the highest tax bracket that existed before 2017, the 39.6 bracket, which would also apply to small businesses that apply under the individual code. We could see changes to capital gains tax treatments, probably changes to the estate tax, a minimum in payment for some foreign income for U.S. companies. And I think what Democrats would do is raise a lot of money from this tax bill in ways that they claim would address income inequality and be fair, ensure that people pay their fair share. That would be how they would sell it. But they would use the money from that bill to pay for an infrastructure bill, which would largely be popular with the American people. And it would include not only infrastructure that we traditionally think of when we think of infrastructure, like roads and bridges and ports and things like that, but also green energy, investments in green energy, new green energy projects, try to give some money to that sector to eventually replace fossil fuels or to minimize fossil fuels. So I think that's the deal that he'll try to go for in 2021. That would allow him to check the tax increase box, the infrastructure box, and the green energy box. And that would be quite an accomplishment for a Democratic president to unify his party, and he could probably sell it in ways that a lot of people in the country might support. Trade-off of tax increases, as long as they're not on them, and offset by a new infrastructure bill.
Well, unfortunately, I think those tax increases would be pretty impactful for just about everybody on the call today. Do you have an assessment or a feeling, would a tax bill or tax increase rather be retroactive to January 1st, or would it be a forward-looking bill?
Well, I think it would be forward-looking. If it was retroactive, Democrats could raise more money and apply more money to infrastructure, which would be attractive to them. But in fairness, it would be prospective. And especially if the economy is still relatively soft early next year, there's going to be a lot of dispute about whether now is the right time to raise taxes. A lot of businesses will still be struggling. Unemployment will be still a little high. I mean, it just may be an awful time to raise taxes. So therefore, they may make it prospective. That may give them an incentive to make it prospective. Democrats claim that the tax increases, as long as they're offset by funding, by spending increases, the markets will like that. And they see that as a plus. So that's how it will be sold. Although I wonder whether it will just simply put a wet blanket on the economy and kind of like reminiscent of the Obama-Biden economy, where they got things back on track, but growth was never significant because excessive regulation kind of threw that wet blanket on top of businesses, and they were too defensive and didn't have a lot of money to spend on things like new hiring and on their employees, and they had to keep that money in reserve for new regulations. So, you know, I wonder if the taxes will serve that same purpose and kind of keep growth in check for the foreseeable future.
I'm going to look for a silver lining here. Do you have a sense of what would happen on limitations on state and local taxes for those of us who live in places with high property taxes and high state taxes?
Yeah, I think that the deduction that was modified would be largely restored, but it would be means tested somehow. So rich people like you couldn't take the full deduction. You'd have to take, you'd get some deduction, and those who made under $50,000 or so would get the full deduction. It would be restored in part, but the full deduction that existed prior to 2017, I don't think will ever be fully reinstated.
That wasn't exactly the silver lining I was looking for, John.
Yeah, I'm not giving you much good news, but you know, I think this is how things look like they're going to play out.
And your perspective is certainly very helpful. You know, it's interesting when you're talking through these different possible changes, right, in your assessment and judgment. Do you think in Washington there's the desire to quickly switch back to what I will call traditional Washington, D.C., and how things were done? I would assume that, at least from the way I view the world, that the Trump administration has been very, very disruptive to how things were traditionally done. Are people looking forward to getting back to the old way of doing things under President Biden, were he to be elected? Or do you think that some things have been broken and will not go back to that?
I think what you mean by, you know, going back to the old way is kind of a more civil environment where debate occurs and, you know, people have views and they vote and then they move on to the next issue, and there's not the obstruction that we've seen over the last, you know, decade or so. I don't think that old system will be returned. I think that, you know, just following the pattern here of good news, I just think that Washington is so politicized today. And the party leaders in particular just desperately want to win so badly. And they see wins not as bipartisan compromises, but as wins specifically and overwhelming for their parties. And there really isn't room for compromise in the calculations of most party leaders. And that's in part because the margins are so small. I mean, you know, Democrats and Republicans, there's not a big difference between their numbers. I mean, in the House, there's 20 more Democrats and Republicans, and that's a pretty good advantage. But in the Senate, it's only 53-47. It's likely to be even tighter next year. And then there's an election 2 years later with all House members and with a third of the senators. So it just never, the campaign cycle just never ends. And as long as they feel the pressures of campaigns, they just want their side to win. And it's just a nonstop combat between them and the other side about which is better and who's doing more and all those things. So I don't see this changing. I mean, sure, if Trump loses, you take away Trump's kind of unique way of communicating out of the equation, you'll certainly see communications out of Washington be a little different. I mean, Biden will, he won't tweet. Biden just has a different way to him. So those things will change, but the underlying fights between the two parties that prevent compromise and that give voters a doubt about how Washington works, I don't see that changing at all. So sorry that I can't be more optimistic, but I think there will continue to be a lot of dysfunction and a lot of unhappiness with Washington.
This is a really, really sunshiny call we're having today. But so again, thinking about, would use the term, I wrote down nonstop combat. And one of the defensive weapons, I guess, in that nonstop combat is the filibuster. And there's discussion about that going away. What are your comments on that likelihood and impact?
Yeah, well, it's a sign that the party in power wants to take advantage of its position to kind of tear down the system so it benefits them. So that would be purely a political move to ensure their agenda can pass unvarnished, not compromised in any way, not subject to the pressures of the compromise that the filibuster ensures. Democrats can do that. If they are in charge next year, they will be the majority party. They have the right to vote on that if they want. Now, it'll come with political costs, probably, but they can do that. That's that. Just like Republicans decided to go ahead with the vote on Judge Barrett in an election year, which many claim was inconsistent with their policy 4 years ago. So parties in the majority do what they want. And in the past, I would say that most of the parties have said, well, no, we can't do that, or we can't pack the court, because that would be, you know, that would upend the balance that's healthy for our system that encourages compromise. So those could just be torn down. And I think it's a reflection of where we've gotten in our system, where people don't respect the system. They just want to win. That's human nature, but it's never really taken over the Senate like it appears to be taking over. And it has been taken over really, you know, last few years and today. So, and that will continue, I think. So I think Democrats will do whatever they have the votes to do. So if they have closer to 55 votes next year, they will likely scrap the filibuster. If they have closer to 50 votes, it'll be harder to do. They need 50 votes to do it. And a couple of Democratic senators have already said that they wouldn't support such an effort. So they're down a couple votes. But if they elect more senators, if they have a good year next month in the elections, then they may have the votes necessary to do it. And they may have the votes to increase the size of the Supreme Court just so they can put more of their judges in. And they may declare Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico states, which would trigger the election of four senators from those two states, certainly would be Democratic senators. So these are things that probably wouldn't have been considered years ago, but in this hyper-partisan environment, they're in play.
Anything goes, huh? That is interesting. Well, I guess you've already said it, and the sense is not necessarily to be concerned about when power flips the other way, that you've taken these stopgap measures out, or, you know, that you've made these changes. It's whatever party is there is getting what they can while they can get it.
Right. That's what they're thinking. And voters may not like it and may punish the party 2 years later, or they may not care about it. You know, it's not a conversation I have with people at the supermarket. They don't ask me about the filibuster or about court pack, but they may, if they're a little more educated and if they saw these as political moves rather than more substantive moves. So it's hard to know where the issues, what kind of impact they'll have. You might recall from history when FDR tried to pack the court in his term. He tried to pack the court because the Supreme Court justices were invalidating some aspects of the New Deal. And he didn't like those decisions. So he tried to expand the court so he could put on his own justices and get and ensure that the court didn't block any of his New Deal provisions. That hurt FDR a lot. And that hurt Democrats back then. Now, FDR won as many times as he ran, but there were other circumstances in his wins that allowed him to win. And this was something that kind of marred his record. So could be an issue that hurts Democrats. And if they do pack the court or end the filibuster, they could be reversed by Republicans if they were to get control back of the Senate. And of course, I'm speaking now hypothetically if Democrats win. If Republicans sure. win, you wouldn't see, the filibuster would remain and the court packing obviously wouldn't be something they would consider. So we're just doing a little bit of theoretical thinking.
I do want to be aware of everyone's time, but we went down a bit, or I at least went down a bit of a rabbit hole based on what you had thought about the polling data and assuming a Biden win. If Trump wins, is it more of the same, or are there things that he has not yet done that you think are on the list that he wants to get done?
There certainly are issues that he would like to get done. You know, usually in a second term, a president will want to cement a legacy and kind of go out with a bang rather than go out with a whimper. And I think that Trump would likely, first of all, he would likely have a Democratic House of Representatives. So his ability to pass legislation would be limited by the Democratic House and Speaker Pelosi. So he might be able to get some things passed through the Senate if that remained in Republican hands, but he would have to do more via the executive branch, which means that more on the trade battles, more on the deregulation front, more on rewriting some current regulations. He would probably try to pick his spots in terms of finding some compromise on certain legislation. And I think he would start with drug prices generally. He's had a longstanding interest in trying to rein in drug prices. He has a lot of common ground with Democrats on how that might occur. And I think he would try very hard to see if he could work out a compromise with Pelosi and Democrats in the Senate. So I think that would be an area of great attention by him if he was reelected. So I think you'd see that be his top priority. Obviously, in addition to trying to rebuild the economy and dealing with COVID, I think that would be the less obvious priority. That would be impactful to many people.
Okay. I've got one more brief kind of line of questioning, and it was interesting on our call with Senator Lindsey Graham the other day when he talked about the power of social media, and then it seems both Republicans and Democrats, perhaps because it impacts them directly in terms of the power of social media influencing messages that are going out to the public, and it seems like both Democrats and Republicans are more and more interested in some sort of regulation or even breakup, and a bunch of names get thrown in that hat, whether it's Facebook or Google or Amazon, or the list goes on and on. What's your sense in either a Trump administration or a Biden administration that, and again, because everyone on the call for the most part are investors as well, and we like to see from that aspect, do these tech giants have something to fear at this point?
Yeah, I think they do. You've noticed gradually over the last couple of years, they've been on the hot seat here in Washington about their practices and whether they dominate the market and whether that's appropriate. some of the CEOs have done better than others in defending their companies, but as long as campaigns rely on social media and tech companies control their platforms and, you know, what people see, it's going to be controversial because, you know, they're going to be called to question about whether they're deleting legitimate content or deleting the right stuff. So there's always going to be controversy, but I think that lawmakers have always tried to persuade the tech company CEOs to change their business practices voluntarily without legislation. I think the reality is that most members of Congress don't know enough about technology to know what they should do. Mm-hmm. Some don't even use a computer. So a lot of these people just don't have any opinion on antitrust or on most things tech because it's kind of beyond them. And I think any antitrust effort or initiative would have to come from the administration. It would more likely come from a Biden administration than a Trump administration. And I'm not sure how the breakups could be proposed. I'm not sure that they would even be suggested, but I certainly wouldn't rule it out, and it would be more likely under Biden than Trump. And I think that'll be a big effort of the next couple of years, will be whether any of the federal agencies do anything about one of these tech companies. I think all the action will be in the executive branch with the Department of Justice rather than Congress. Congress will make a lot of noise, but I don't think they'll pass any bills that'll break up the companies. I just don't think they're there yet. So yeah, I think it's a legitimate issue, and it could be sidestepped by tech companies changing their business models or loosening up some of the parts that they now control. But on its current path, it looks like there's going to be some kind of showdown over antitrust in the next couple of years.
Okay. Well, John, as always, you and I could go on for hours. I think it would be easy to do, but in the interest of time, I really want to thank you for occupying your unique position, and you're a very valuable resource for us. And I thank you very much for your time today.
Sure. Well, thank you, Andrew. Anything I can do, and to everyone else on the phone, I'm part of Andrew and Tom's team, so consider me a part of their team. And if you ever need anything or have any questions or want anything Washington outlined, just let me know through them.
That's great, John. Thank you again. I thank everybody for joining us on the call today. As John said, if there's any follow-ups or individual points you'd like to spend some time on, reach out directly to either Tom or myself. We can get John or someone on his team out on the call as well if we need. So thank you, everybody, and enjoy the rest of the day.